taking it down.
Welcome to Taking It Down, and we're the podcast that supposedly talks about pop culture like television, movies, music, and books. We don't know where it's going to go today. We are produced by the Alabama Take, which is a website that deserves your attention, and that's not just because they pay me to say that. There is plenty to see and read at the website devoted to more pop culture, sports, politics, culture. Speaking of the website, the Alabama Take is giving away a 2-record set of 7-inch vinyl collection of the 2009 Eddie Hinton tribute set produced by Shake It Records and kindly given to us by Travis Tolbert. And then another person will win a $25 gift card of their choice. What's the catch? Well, we're trying to get you to get vaccinated and prove it, and just to make sure you know the directions and help us promote a little bit. If you'll pick your favorite episode of Short Takes and share it and your vax card, then that'll enter you to win. Just make sure we know about it. Tag us so that we can see it or let us know where to look for it. We'll put you in the lottery and, you know, you can win one of those two things. You have until Monday, August 6th to get all that done. So go get vaxxed or dig up your card if you're already vaxxed. Share the YouTube show and be one of the two winners. Do all three.
Might throw my damn hat in the ring here.
I don't think you're eligible, Donovan.
I got a card somewhere, Blaine.
I'm just saying, as an employee of the Alabama Take.
You're saying that just because you pay me money to do things, that I'm not eligible for your giveaway.
You burned that bridge with all that PTO the last few weeks.
Anyway, if you do it on all three major social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, we'll happily put your name in the hat 3 times.
If they do it on another, like if they send you a snap showing them putting it on like a billboard or something, what's that worth?
Well, I debated Snapchat and TikTok, but usually those end up on Instagram anyway, so it would be double dipping in a way on that. But let's get into today's episode of our podcast. We're covering a few things. The new documentary on HBO and HBO Max called Woodstock 99, Peace, Love, and Rage. We'll talk a little bit about Bob Dylan's recent movie, Shadow Kingdom. And we'll talk about the HBO show 100 Foot Wave and the famed Apple TV Plus series that keeps bringing joy to all, Ted Lasso, has just started. Okay, with all that said, I'm your host, Blaine Duncan. Joining me today, you've already heard from them, my friends, my co-hosts. They are Adam Morrow. They are Donovan Reinwald. I guess we should welcome Donovan back to the show.
I guess
after
so.
Some paid time off.
How was the cape?
Thank you. The cape was great. I'm, of course, talking about the short-lived NBC series.
We've got some crowd acknowledgement. Man, welcoming Donovan back. There it is. That was real live studio audience. Hey, are we on the verge of having to resurrect our COVID segment? And I'm saying this with sincere disappointment.
Yeah.
For the love of all that's holy, how in the fuck did we get here?
I think we're there.
Well, I think it's pretty easy to get here.
Go on, Donovan. It's easy. Go on.
If a bunch of people don't do the thing they really should be doing, then the bad thing's pretty easy to get.
These are the same sons of bitches that complain about shutting down, wearing masks, and now they won't go do the one thing that would prevent us from shutting down, wearing masks, people dying. I mean, what the fuck do you want?
What do I want, Blaine? I want to not live in fear.
You want to live with freedom?
I want to live with freedom.
My body, my choice.
Putting a mask on my face might as well be admitting to everybody that I'm not an American.
Not a man.
Might as well be.
Okay, Frenchie.
It's, Alabama has, what, a 30% vax rate?
39
Sorry,
of yesterday.
Sorry, closer to 40 than 30. Oof.
No, wait, 34. I'm sorry, Adam. 34. It was 33.9. There you go. Sorry.
What,
as of yesterday.
What's it like in Connecticut? What's the percentage there?
We're over 70. Oh, it's over 70%.
Wow. 99.9.
God, that's crazy.
Heck, I've been playing in Vermont's well over 80%. They're at,
I'm sure.
You know, despite with people not counting people coming in, they're at basically herd immunity up there.
And that's just Bernie Sanders.
He's been going door to door and giving them out himself.
I mean, in like a little bit of all seriousness, obviously, if you have access issues or there's historic distrust, that's a different thing. But
it is. But
what's going on now is like, you know, we're spreading it to kids and stuff like that. Like,
yes,
that's not cool.
The variant, the Delta variant, is easier spread. It's maybe even a little stronger. Maybe not. I shouldn't say such a thing. I'm not a scientist. Don't believe me. But
I have it on good authority that the Delta variant.
You make it sound like a snack.
It may or may not be stronger. It may or may not be more contagious, but it does make you 1,000% hornier.
Donovan needs.
1,000%. Don't get it.
What is going on?
You just gonna get you a tummy ache.
We shouldn't give you weeks off anymore, Donovan.
You've lost in the weeds out there.
I had a handful of Chex Mix, and you know I'm just ready to roll over here.
We're talking semi-serious, at least. The Alabama Take, we ran a poll on Twitter. Twitter-only poll, so it's very scientific. And it's our fan base on Twitter, which is, again, just a huge slice of America. Our Twitter poll of, are you fully vaccinated against COVID? You got the option of yes, no, or I will be soon. There are some people still, you know, working that out. 92% of people are vaccinated that follow us on Twitter. 4% no, 4% will be soon, and that's out of 25 votes.
What is Jeff's problem?
Yes. Hey, I want to know who the... I think it was one person that said... If my math's right, it's one person that says no. Who the hell follows us, and is it vaccinated? And hopefully it's just... I don't know what I could say, hopefully, but... You know, maybe there's a good reason, but I just can't think of one.
So, like, you're sitting here hoping they're really immunocompromised?
I don't know. Maybe they had maybe they had COVID last month, and they're just like, well, I haven't done it yet. I don't know. Shit.
It's such a weird thing, because, like, when you really... You want to try to understand why somebody wouldn't do it, you know? I mean, some people are just...
Do you?
Yeah, I mean, because some people are totally going just to be obstinate about whatever topic it is. You know, like, speak of Jeff, who just swears that the Nolan Batman movies are not the best. It's like, that. It's just objective, you're wrong. You know, like,
God,
all
that's
of,
one of his worst takes. Right?
All of society.
That is a bad take.
This is, I'm not picking on Jeff in particular, but we all have these people who, and you know, some of us from time to time have an opinion like that. So there are just assholes like that with this vaccine. But there's also has to be a lot of people, Donovan, you said earlier, mistrust in systems of government and medical providers, whatever, like what cocktail of fear and I'll just say it again, mistrust lands us here. It's so weird. I mean, part of this distribution, you know, it could be hard for some folks to get. Donovan, you said that too. I don't know. Absolutely. I want to try to understand why someone wouldn't do it.
See, you're a better man than I. When it comes to things like this, I totally get into my little bubble and just throw my hands in the air and say, fuck these people. And I don't even try to understand them. So good for you for wanting to understand.
Oh, I mean, part of it is it pisses me off. I'm not sympathetic to them unless they have, like, you know, they're like, well, I'm going through chemotherapy. That's why I'm not. It's,
of course.
That's a different thing.
Of course. Of course.
But it... I don't know. You know, I'm thinking like totally selfishly in the music industry. Like if things start shutting down again, it's just catastrophic. Now that people are finally the glimmers of hope that started the summer and where we are now with shows being canceled again, all that kind of stuff. It's, come on, y'all.
And if you are a black person and you say that you're not vaccinated and you're real hesitant, that is fair to me. That's 100% fair. Because if you've been treated... As a community, you've been treated like shit your entire life. Your family has, and your grandparents have, so I get that. But I'm not talking to the black community. The people I'm seeing making such stupid claims are white people, mainly in the AL.com comment section. You know, where the dumb go to get dumber.
Yeah,
that's a self-selecting sample you're pulling. Do you think
yes, it is, but look at the numbers. We're at 34% vaccination. What the fuck?
Do you think if you went there and you were like, guys, the only thing you have to do to, like, not get COVID is just don't drink antifreeze. Like, do you think they'd be drinking antifreeze tomorrow?
I might do that. I might every day this week I'm going to post, guys, whatever you do, don't drink antifreeze. And we'll just see if we can't
Like, I voted for Joe Biden, and if you drink antifreeze, it'll make me cry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, speaking of national affairs, how are you guys? This is, I hope, a short segment because I'll get into why. How are you guys on the Olympics? Because I'll go ahead and tell you, and you can answer. I don't give a shit. Just do not give a shit. I can't make myself. I'll go so far as to say this. Not only do I not give a shit, but I think it's time to stop having them because it's costly. It's stupid. It's more harm than good.
I just love that point number two was just, it's stupid.
It is stupid. Totally. Who the fuck really cares about water polo? Be honest with me.
That was going to be my point, because where else can I watch archery and water polo in the same 20 minutes, Blaine?
Are you just hungry for it every 4 years to the point where you're, oh, bless you.
Come on, Team USA, let's go. Here's how we balance it out environmentally wise. We just promise to never make another Transformers movie, and that money and waste can go.
If that's on the table,
we can use it up.
If that's on the table, I'm willing to hear these negotiations.
Blaine, is this always your opinion, or has the COVID situation poured some gasoline on that fire?
It's been my opinion for the last 16 to 20 years. Yeah.
Why do you hate the human spirit?
I hate nationalism, and I think that this feeds into that a little. I hate waste. Ever since climate change has been on my mind, existentially on my mind, keeping me up at night, so let's say 20 to 26 years, I have been anti almost anything that can increase or make it worse. You know, wasn't it Brazil that had just basically built a city and now it's just standing there going to waste?
Yeah,
that's like every single Olympics venue.
Well, there you go. That's what I was going to use them as the example, but then I was going to follow up by asking, don't they do that every 4 years, every country? And that's stupid. Give it to homeless people.
Is that you don't think that Liechtenstein deserves its chance to send its 5 athletes to Tokyo? That's what I'm hearing right now. Liechtenstein.
You're reading me perfectly, Donald.
If you were a proud Liechtensteiner, I bet you'd be feeling differently, right? I bet your feelings be hurt by this.
I'm into the
our
Olympics.
Audience and Liechtenstein. Okay, so here's our counterpoint. Adam, you're for them, huh?
Yeah. I think what you're talking about with the nationalism, I understand, but I also see, you know, people talk about the kind of the low-key politics that happen, but it's also a celebration of, Donovan kind of jokingly said, the human spirit, but like, you know, all these athletes from all over the place get together around
and fuck.
That seems to be every year. There's the articles about the condoms they give out in the Olympic Villa, the athletes village or whatever. But
are they extra big and extra strong just because they're so athletic? And
I think they have to
so
be
hung.
Right.
I don't know.
I think the whole thing's kind of cool though. If you are a water polo player, I may not want to watch you do your sport on my television, but it's cool that, you know, you ascended to this place where you get to go be around other people who love the sport that you love and compete. You know, if you're in the Olympics, that's for life. You get to always say, yeah, I was an Olympian.
I'll make my final point, and I hope both of you can agree with. It turns people on Twitter into sudden experts every 4 years on
the absolute
archery.
Worst.
Oh my, like, when did you become Mr. Name the obscure sport? When did you become Mr. Whatever?
Mr. Dressage.
Yeah.
Thank you.
My favorite Batman villain.
That's pretty good, Donovan.
People reacting to the Olympics in that way should have prepared us for the pandemic, really.
Like, if they know so much.
True.
Yeah, it's like, you've never seen water polo before, and now you're extolling the finer points of the sport. Of course you would think you could decipher whether this vaccine is, you know, clinically safe or whatever.
Yeah, like I never knew America had so many public health experts, both real ones and other ones.
Donovan, since you like the Olympics, what is your favorite off the beaten path sport?
Yeah, sure.
You know, I really do kind of like archery. I think it's very cool.
It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and it's I
no,
like
it's
no, it's such a mental game, and they have like a shot clock and everything. Like archery's cool. I do kind of like that some of the shooting sports are neat just because it is so mental. Like I listened to a NPR thing probably either 4 or 8 years ago. I don't remember about what it's like to be to do. I can't remember any of the actual names of the sports, but what it's like to be doing any of those sports. And it just is like now watching them, I'm just fascinated by what's going on.
I think I'd be more open to the Olympics if they narrowed it to 10 sports or 15.
I mean, it's kind of the attraction. There's always something going on, right?
Yeah, I get it.
So you're like baseball, football, American football, football.
Hell yeah. Hockey, soccer, yes.
I do think it's funny. Well, soccer, it's not a big tournament for soccer. It's kind of a snooze fest because they send, it's like the under 23 teams. I think it's under 23.
Years of age, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah, the big soccer tournaments are the World Cup and the Euros. Most of the best soccer players in the world are already back at their club teams, so it's not that exciting. Mm-hmm. But
AF Richmond?
Yeah, they're back at AF Richmond. That's right. I don't know. On the nationalism side, it's kind of funny when the basketball team got beat this morning.
They did.
And the women's soccer team got beat in their first game. And it's kind of funny to see, you know, anytime that American exceptionalism or entitled, not that the athletes are entitled, but, well, the NBA player is probably entitled, but we think as a country, of course, we're just going to walk all over everybody in basketball or women's soccer or whatever. You know, it's kind of fun to get the reality check.
For the record, the 92 Dream Team was the last time I cared about the Olympics.
Pure magic.
Oh yeah, like in more ways than one. Yeah, magic was on that team.
Self agrees with you.
God damn, that was a team. I'm just curious if you guys watched the Olympics or not, and where you were. Let's talk about when we came here to dissect. I threw that as a curveball, but you guys handled it wonderfully. Let's talk about what's really on the docket. We've got the newly released documentary on Woodstock '99 called Woodstock '99: Peace, Love, and Rage. Yeah, brought to you by Bill Simmons Production Company. It airs on HBO Max. I think it might be airing on HBO as well. As the name implies, which to me, that's actually where the implications end. It's with the name. It's about Woodstock in the year of our Lord, 1999. Just before we start dissecting this, there's no spoilers at all. If you remember anything about Woodstock 99, then you will remember a lot of what happens in this documentary. This is Music Box. It kind of goes under this heading, Music Box. I think Bill Simmons is planning on doing, like, what, some music documentaries? Is this, Adam, do you know anything more about this? Don, do you?
I don't. When I first clicked on it in the HBO app and it popped up and it showed as a series, I thought, well, I misunderstood that this is going to be episodic
Same.
Then I saw, no, this is a 2-hour documentary, so I need to do some more reading on what Bill's up to. He's just growing that empire.
He sure is. Yeah, it looks like, I mean, if I'll watch more music documentaries if they're well, you know, if they're good, if they're well done, this bodes well. I was also surprised. I thought I'd clicked on the wrong thing or misunderstood.
But yeah, what it seems like is he and his production crew are going to release music documentaries every now and again. That's my guess. Bill Simmons has already been in production with HBO. He did the Andre the Giant documentary about four or five years ago.
Did he do that? Mm-hmm. I did not remember that.
That was really good. So kudos to my mortal enemy, Bill Simmons. Let's get into it. Again, I don't know. Can you spoil a documentary? Probably not. We are going to talk about it very extensively up until the break. So if you want to wait to hear what we think before you've digested it, check our timestamps, and you'll be good to go. So this movie wore its thesis on its sleeve so constantly that I found it hard to say anything more than just repeat what was on screen and tell you what I thought about those instances. Adam, I'm going to toss it to you. Where would you begin with this?
I thought it was really good. It was a, you know, the thesis kind of being not only that this is the end of the 90s dream, if there can be such a thing. Maybe that's a less pronounced idea than the 60s. If you want to say that Altamont ended that, it's not quite on that level. Yeah, as far as like, you know, an end of a real cultural moment, the 90s is a bit of a looser idea, but, you know, them doing that and then kind of tying it to, you know, this outpouring of angry young white men who are now angry white adult men. Like a lot of those people are still around. I think they definitely hit that pretty hard, but I thought it worked. There were, you know, like any documentary that's that, whose topic is that expansive, there were things that I would have enjoyed seeing more of. They kept showing the full list of bands who played. Just some footage of bands playing would have been a nice touch. I mean, I realized it already had a 2-hour runtime, but, you know, when you show Korn and Limp Bizkit and Kid Rock and these famous moments, you know, like when Korn is on stage, they're the first ones where, like, the crowd truly goes bananas. Like, it looks like however many 100,000 people are on a trampoline together and just waves rippling and out from the stage.
That's the first, maybe not first, but that was one of the moments where my eyes got much wider and I thought, damn, I would hate to be there.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Donovan, what's the Venn diagram of the young men in this crowd versus the people who aren't vaxxed right now?
I was thinking more like the young men in this crowd and storming the Capitol has got to be nearly a perfect circle, right?
One of the interesting things, I'm glad they put it in. I'll finish that thought with just saying that, you know, like Al Green and Willie Nelson and a handful of others were on there. I would have loved to have seen, what the hell does Willie Nelson do on Sunday on that stage, you know?
Yes, that would have been great to see.
It would have just been interesting.
Yeah, you're right. They did leave out.
That would have been
those,
cool.
Those artists. So the same guys that did Woodstock 69 are the same guys who did this. It's Lang and Scheer. Isn't his name Michael Lang?
Real cool guy.
Okay, so same guys who did Woodstock 69 are the same guys who did this. It's Michael Lang and John Scheer. They're utter classless dickheads.
Well, it's just the overwhelm. Like, I'm sitting here remembering what I watched last night. Just the overwhelming cynicism I feel towards them. Just the, how utterly, I mean, like, nakedly cynical this endeavor was.
No, you can see it in their eyes, in that 99 footage.
It's like, come on. It's hard to even say anything because you're just, like, so overwhelmed, which is the cat. Like, they didn't care.
No.
As long as they made money. Like, they didn't care what they did.
So they interview them present day, and they interview them in 99. There's even a little footage of them in 69. But you can see it in that footage from 99 that they have plans to do another show in 5 years and so on Absolutely. And so on, so that they can continue to be rich and white and pricks. And they're just going to milk this for what it is. And it turns into this perfect metaphor of boomers turning something peaceful, loving. Now, look, Woodstock 69 wasn't perfect. You know, they talk about that as well in the documentary. But they turned something that was relatively close to that, at least in the vein, into this capitalistic pile of shit. There's this, it feels as though that bled right into electing the second Bush. A turning point from 99 to 2000 really was, into what we've become today. 20 years later?
It is kind of, I don't know how, I think this is a little bit too much of a stretch, but like, watching this, all I could think was like, wow, good governance actually matters.
Like, No, that's exactly one of my points.
You know, just the you know, the way things were set up, didn't care. Like, it's like, it couldn't help but fail.
Oh, no, I noted at some point, either during or after watching this, it may not want to be, but it's making an argument for regulation and that making money hand over fist makes you not only less human, but you turn even your proletariat into animals.
Sure. It's like, I can't, you know, I keep trying wanting to use the word anarchy, and anarchy is a bad word for it. So I think I think almost what it seemed like was just like the most cynical libertarianism. It's like, do whatever you want as long as we're making money.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't, you know, it doesn't really matter what's going on.
Uh-huh.
And you are nothing but a product.
I am with you. It's captivating. It's a captivating document.
Yes.
I saw a female journalist online say that, and I did, and this is one of our faults for not having a lady on the show today. A lot of times Natalie will join us, but she tweeted that this movie should come with a warning, and that she was very much affected by the repeated footage of ladies being groped and topless. And she even questioned how in the world could they have ever known that all of those young ladies was over the age of 18 or 19.
So I was actually thinking that, and mine did come with a warning. Did yours? As of last, I watched mine last night. And
I don't remember. I don't think so.
This contains footage of sexual abuse. But I did kind of, you know, so they had a point where they were a point about, maybe it was a little bit before the midway point, talking about the sexual exploitation of women during this. But they used a lot of footage of topless women and people crowd surfing. And I just kind of wondered, you know, it's kind of the classic problem, right? Like, how do you talk about the bad thing without just being the bad thing?
Yeah.
Can you show the bad thing without, showing the bad thing?
Right.
And I don't think anybody, I doubt anybody went in this with, ill intent or anything, but I do wonder if, I do wonder what the, if it couldn't have come through some other way, perhaps, right? Do we need all this footage of, you know, people who presumably are not consenting to this?
And
to be in the documentary, I mean.
I think it was just that pervasive that mm-hmm. you couldn't hardly scan the camera around the crowd without seeing it.
I think there's two things with that. One is that the camera guys were clearly told to look for that. You know, it's a pay-per-view event, and I'm sure that there were production meetings where they said, if they didn't say it out loud, it was maybe they pulled them aside later and said, hey, you know what sells. You know what the image that we're trying to produce. And I think that is incriminating to what they were trying to do, because it also feeds into the, I thought they did a fairly good job talking about the Woodstock 69 was not, it has been framed a certain way. You know, people died in 1969 mm-hmm. at Woodstock. It's not like it was just, you know, everybody took acid and hung out and the bands were great or whatever. It was, you know. They talked about trucking food in and water and all this kind of stuff. It was a catastrophic organizational failure. And part of that's because people gate crashed and they didn't really have a good concept of what a festival was at the time and how to prepare for what they needed to prepare for. The talking about it being so prevalent, the not only topless women or whatever, but ones, being groped, it's stacked up. You know, when you watch for 2 hours and you see it over and over again, and the fact that it's not the same footage ever, you know, that they don't belabor they do belabor the point, but it's not like there's only a few instances. It's like when the organizers say, there was only 10, you can check the police records. It's like, I just saw an uncountable 30. Number of it. And it is hard to watch, no matter. If you are you talking about someone writing that it's a triggering experience. I mean, I think it's uncomfortable mm-hmm. no matter what, you know, if you mm-hmm. are a survivor or just someone sitting down to watch a documentary.
The same reporter notes that it could very well be the largest sexual assault at one time in a certain, in the last 50 years or something.
Yeah. I mean, it was...
When you look at it like that.
Yeah, how many times have people gathered in mass like that, you know? So that makes total sense. I did read a bit this morning. There was Donovan, you go ahead. I don't want to change topics.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think they did a pretty good, we were kind of talking about what's their thesis. I think they did a pretty good job of drawing a through line of the misogyny behind, mm-hmm. A lot of the acts and attendees and even just the way it was planned. It all, they really do a good job of making it all kind of fit as a piece. Like, of course this happened because the misogyny was baked in from the beginning.
Yeah, I'm glad you guys read that same argument, because that's what I was seeing as well. Adam, you're talking about something you had read, though, this morning.
Yeah, there's been a bit of a reaction from a few music critics. They noted that there was not a lot of women involved in the writing or production of this, or on screen. And it's an interesting, for something whose thesis is angry young white men did these terrible things, this misogynistic, racism gets brought up. You know, that very uncomfortable scene where the crowd is singing along and, like, a little too...
Oh man.
Yeah.
Yes. With DMX?
Yeah. So yeah. You do wonder about, you know, even when you're trying to investigate something, how much mansplaining is happening about misogyny, you know? Like,
that's
if you,
a good point.
Yeah, yeah, which is... Yeah, I don't want to get into that here, but... You know,
and the double irony that now three dudes are talking about it on this podcast.
Yeah,
but.
I hope it doesn't sound quite like that. I will say that the lack of women acts on the bill in 1999 was shameful, and it was by design. I was 100% by design.
One a day.
It was kind of shocking, and it was. I really thought it was interesting. Oh, I'm sorry, Blake.
No. I was just going to say I remember listening to a lot of female artists all throughout my music listening, and to only find three that would do the 1999, that's by design.
Yeah, absolutely. It took a certain level of guts to me to, like, you know, every time they showed footage of the crowd, there were just bottles flying through the air. I mean, it seemed like there were 100 in the air at any given time. And to walk into that environment, like, if you're Alanis Morissette, and to do your thing... That takes guts.
Yeah, it really does.
That's what I was thinking, too.
You could tell some of these acts, when they were done, they got off stage. You know, even Rage Against the Machine, when they were done, Tom Morello was off that stage. It seemed like, and maybe that was not, I'm reading something into body language that wasn't actually there, but it did not look like I just can't imagine being... me and walking in and having to play something like that. And I certainly can't imagine being a woman involved in any of those bands walking into that.
I can't either.
Can you imagine, like playing for a bunch of guys who, like, they want to see Limp Bizkit, and now you're Alanis Morissette and you've got to do your whole set?
Yeah.
And just how scary that must
have like been. Actual nuanced music, and they're just screaming, you know, take your top off or something.
I bet you just think about how much you're getting paid and just try to focus on that and then get the fuck off. No encore, no nothing, right?
Yeah. I guess so.
Hey, Alanis is a pro.
Yeah.
Yes, she is. Adam, Moby talks about the sixth sense about how a show or venue, you can feel it, even like outside the doors. You ever have that?
Haven't you?
Yes, but you've played live a whole lot more than I have, and I'm just fascinated by this idea that, oh, shit, kind of feeling you get even when you're loading into a venue.
Yeah. No, that's definitely a thing. And I think, to me, it has become, as we get further and further away from this cultural moment, like, I feel like when I started playing music, there were still the leftovers of that kind of, like, bro heavy, let's just get trashed and, you know, this is a good time. And now it's, I think places are a little bit more accommodating and welcoming, so it doesn't happen quite as often. But yeah, sometimes you pull up somewhere and you're like, this is a dark place. There's a dark energy here.
Yeah. If I think the three of us are all on the same page, Trump should be arrested for inciting a riot. So should Fred Durst.
Holy smokes, man.
So should he.
Unless, like, I think you could make an argument that he's too dumb to know what he's doing. Like, if I was his lawyer,
which
that's the tack I would take.
Either one. I will say, the Rolling Stone article that Rob Sheffield wrote, he was actually there.
Right.
And
yes, he was.
He thought that the scapegoating that was done against Fred Durst was possibly a little unfair. He didn't think that the Durst deserved quite as much of the... You know, he wasn't interviewed. He didn't get to state his case, for whatever reason that may have been the producer's decision. But he said he remembers Durst saying things like, hey, if somebody falls down, help him back up. Like that kind of thing. Trying to... Mm-hmm. It wasn't all bad. It was, they made a supercut for the documentary of his worst moments. And this is, it feels very odd to be defending him in any way right now. But the article's point was, you can blame the organizers much more than you can blame him. Mm-hmm. That he became, both sides, both the organizers and us at large, look at him and can point fingers. And if both sides are pointing fingers at him, that's like the ultimate deflection tactic, right?
I mean, John Scheer blames women. He literally blames women in his current present day 2020-2021 interview.
Has anyone regretted an interview more than when they sat down to watch this thing?
I hope so.
Man.
And then back in 99, he was blaming MTV. So never once did this asshole take any kind of responsibility for what was happening.
You know, I was sitting watching that, and I was like thinking, like, of course he's not going to take any responsibility. Probably be legally liable if he did.
I guess,
like,
so.
Could people, you know, from just the crimes and harm that was done.
I love that he I love that he specifies Kurt Loder. He's like, Kurt Loder's out there lying. Why would Kurt Loder lie on camera in the moment in 1999 about feeling harmed? He said he wants to be a war reporter. Dude, go. If you just watch that footage, you think.
No, he doesn't. He works for MTV. He looks scared.
He looks scared.
I mean, Carson Daly, like, dodging missiles from the. Missiles, not like a war reporter way, but I mean, you know, projectiles thrown at him from the crowd. Who knows? If, you know, somebody throws a full beer can at you, that's bad news.
Mm-hmm. Adam, did you notice how rife the lineup was with acts that appeared on This Song Sucks? Red Hot Chili Peppers, Metallica, Limp Bizkit. And I do encourage a lot of people to go back and listen to This Song Sucks, the Limp Bizkit episode of Nookie. We kind of piece it together that his phony anger really does link to the incel movement. We made that connection several months ago before this documentary aired. And I think there is truly something to be said about Limp Bizkit's fake anger versus Rage Against the Machine's warranted and righteous anger.
Yeah.
And that was never pointed out in the documentary. Yeah, I guess they were running out of time.
I think
it's interesting how they kind of got clumped in together, and they're doing very different things with a very different makeup, and they're putting their kind of their money where their mouth is in very different ways.
I thought Jewel probably said it best. I believe it was Jewel. She said you want culturally something to galvanize around, and the 90s, that generation, who were a little too young for grunge, or they thought it was kind of passe or whatever, if they're coming of age, you know, if they're in that target demographic, say 16 to 24 in 99, they don't really have anything. You know, it's that Fight Club kind of thing where, like, what are we mad about that nothing's really happening? You know, that we're not, there's not some great occasion or whatever.
Yeah.
And you let people sit out and get angry and try to invent something to get angry about, and this just, like, nihilistic chaos ensues, which I think all of that music was.
Yeah, it does feel very. There's a real there's a real streak of nihilism, right, running through the whole thing.
I thought
just the, like, who gives a shit kind of.
Yeah, I told Natalie when it was over. I said, I think we have a friend whose son is going to start college next year, and he loves metal, adores metal. Him and Hayden talk about it often. So I think he should, like, have to watch this to understand why metal left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. Not that he listens to anything that maybe Metallica or, you know, a Megadeth or something like that, but they're into much, you know, stoner and sludge and that kind of stuff, which was not represented there. It's a totally different thing. But as a, you know, the touchstones of the genre that are, you know, loud guitars and vague anger or just loud voices, whatever, you know, there's a reason that a lot of people say that indiedom ran in the complete and total opposite direction for the next 10, 15 years after this was over.
Mm-hmm. When the Chili Peppers played Fire, I thought, oh, how it must be nice to be pampered and not have to go down amongst the peons.
You know,
all I could think of was that thing Josh shared on This Song Sucks about Anthony Kiedis doing flips the whole time.
Go on.
No, just like it was like I've seen his dumb face, and it's like Josh just shared a story about like they look out, you know, like they show up somewhere and they look out the window and there's Kiedis doing just flips, and it's like, of course this dumbass is like, what's the best thing I can do here? Well, I can't do any flips on this stage. Time to play fire.
I think that they, it was funny when they did that kind of highlight reel of bands attempting to pay tribute to the original Woodstock and it just totally falling flat or nobody understanding it. I think that they probably learned fire and spent like days on it before the show, and they're like, well, we got to play it. We practiced it for the last 5 hours or whatever. I don't think there was any conscious decision. It was just like, what's a great Jimi Hendrix song? Oh, fire, let's play that. Should they have cut it?
Yeah,
of course. But do I sympathize with wanting to play the cover that you've worked hard on? Yes, I do.
Yeah, all right. We'll take our break on the other side. Little Ted Lasso. Hey, listeners, we thank you for joining us every Tuesday or when you get a chance to tune in. Do you listen at work? I'd be curious to know. In the car, in the gym, while tuning out your husband or your wife or your boyfriend or girlfriend? Anyway, we'll take this break to let you know a few specific things around the site. We do know that there's another bonus episode coming from This Song Sucks. We mentioned that in the previous segment. It's going to look back on the first season a little. That should be out soon, and then not long after, in the fall, will be This Song Sucks Season 2. Continuing the brilliance that's established with the show, This Song Sucks, we've got short takes on YouTube. Out every Friday on YouTube and the website, The Alabama Take. This Friday, we're going to be chatting with famed singer, performer, songwriter Paul Thorne. Subscribe to the YouTube channel lest you find yourself excluded from some of those conversations. Don't forget about sharing your favorite episode of Short Takes as well as your Vax card to enter our giveaway. As for the Alabama Take in general, you're always welcome to come help with the site or write or do anything you want related to the site. You can even donate just to help out with finances. There's more. We have an online store with some select products, and we got a few things coming soon. Keep your eye out for that. Let's get back into today's Taking It Down. So last Sunday was Shadow Kingdom, Bob Dylan's latest endeavor. Streaming concert film left a lot of viewers puzzled going in and going out. That's per Dylan's want. He didn't give a lot of fanfare to begin the show, not really even telling what it was going to be. No one really knew if it was going to be a concert, a filmed event, a live show. Ended up being a black and white concert film, which was shot at a small club. I know neither of you watched it. Did you do any reading on Shadow Kingdom?
It was kind of impossible not to encounter some Twitter feedback. I knew that I was busy last Sunday night and would be to start the week, so I didn't buy the pass. It wasn't really a conscious choice to not watch. I obviously hope to get to it, but yeah, the Twitter feed was saturated with takes on Sunday and Monday and Tuesday for sure.
Any of particular interest or humor?
People seemed, I guess I've curated that part of my feed to just have folks who were very enthusiastic about it. There was no like confusion, no what the hell is he doing kind of stuff. It was just celebration of the fact that he's still here doing interesting things.
Gotcha.
Blaine, I have one question for you.
Okay.
Who is Bob Dylan?
So he's a guy. Yeah. Let's get into, really quickly, I don't know that we'll have a lot to say, but who knows? HBO limited documentary series 100 Foot Wave is now airing every Sunday. It's a look at a decade-long attempt of this legendary surfer. He's legendary in surfer circles, Garrett McNamara. His goal is to surf the biggest wave, or a 100-foot wave, the largest wave ever. Directed by Chris Smith, and only one episode's aired as of this recording, but I had no intention of watching this. But it was on, I think, after I watched The White Lotus last week, and I was just letting the TV play as I scrolled through my phone, and I happened to catch myself looking up more and more and more to the point where I finally just sat the phone down and realized I was watching it. And I didn't think anything else about it until Adam messaged me. You know, I think he messaged both of us, Donovan, and it really does captivate you, right? And how did you, Adam, did you come to the show purposefully?
Well, I'm a giant wave enthusiast.
Is that true?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
I don't, this is just one of those things. Now I'm glad that everyone who listens to the podcast will know. Thoroughly landlocked by 4 or 5 hours here in North Alabama. So it's not like a surf thing, nothing like that. I think I'm just in awe of when the ocean produces giant waves. Like I'll get on YouTube and watch ships going through giant waves and that kind of stuff. I love it. I think there's
not only that, but you hate the beach.
I like the ocean. I just dislike like a sandy Gulf of Mexico or hot part of the Atlantic beach. I like the ocean. If it's cool outside, I just don't like going and sitting in 100 degree heat in a crowded area in the sand when the water feels like a bathtub. I'm not into that.
That's fair. You could just stick your head in your oven and get the same effect.
Yeah. I hate summer, so, but the ocean in general, like say where they are in Portugal, looks just stunningly beautiful.
Which is where some of this show is shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Places like that, I'm way into it. I think the unknowability of the ocean is kind of fascinating to me on like a, I don't know, mystical, existential, spiritual level. And the idea of something so big and so powerful that, you know, I think that's like an easy, wherever you go, there you are kind of like deep thought that there's more ocean than land in all of these places that are relatively close to us that we don't know or understand or can't get to or understand or whatever. And so the idea that, you know, like with the, what creates the wave in Portugal is a giant underwater canyon, bigger than the Grand Canyon, that pushes a wave in a certain way and it rises up. And I was familiar with the spot because there's a lot of famous pictures taken there and videos and stuff where it looks like the wave is just going to come in and destroy that lighthouse and everybody standing around it. I mean, it just looks like a Manhattan skyline of water in front of them. I just think that's fascinating. And the
is your favorite Neil Young song, I'm the Ocean?
Let's see, on the beach, he's at the wrong kind of beach. A lot of sand going on there. the documentary, I'm not, you know, I like outdoor sports stuff. I'm a sucker for a sports documentary in general. But the surfing part was interesting. But even, I feel like the documentary makers knew it was secondary to the story that they're telling. That, you know, what causes someone to decide to go out and do this. And I thought a lot of the times it can feel a bit, outdoor sports in general, like a white dude shows up to go and do this thing in a foreign country, and you're just kind of like, what do the locals think about these idiots doing this stuff? Uh-huh. And it was interesting to see like the community actually get involved in it and kind of how all of that works. And yeah, I thought it was great.
More episodes to come. And did you plan on watching it? Had you seen some sort of advertisement?
Oh yeah, I knew it was coming. I was excited.
Much like the wave itself. Huh?
Yeah, that's right. No, any HBO quality footage of giant waves, I'm in.
It just caught me by surprise. I had no idea it existed. But yeah, I'm glad I do. It's thoroughly engaging in a way that I can't hardly put my finger on. That's why I'm letting you sort of tell me why I think I'm interested.
I mean, I think it's when he goes out there, it's like he could die. You know, it's a very real possibility. Or the idea of when they're talking about having to have some sensitivity with the town itself, because it is an old fishing village and then town where that's how they made a living and survived, was to go into the ocean and earn a living and collect food, and you know, it was dangerous. And they had everybody that they're talking to knew somebody in the family history who died on the ocean. It grounded it in a way so that when you see him out there, it's like, oh, the stakes are very high. It doesn't feel like exploitation of it either. It feels like there's a respect between him and where he is. I don't know. I thought it was great.
In the first 10 or 15 minutes of the movie, they show Garrett McNamara in Hawaii with one of their early big wave competitions, and he escapes a wave still on his surfboard. He rides it perfectly and comes out the other end. And they show it about four times in a row because the producers realize, you have no idea how he escapes this thing.
No.
Even if you watch it 15 times. It's like he's CGI'd in there. It's just amazing.
They said that is probably I guess that's being in the barrel, right? We're obviously not surfers here. But
nope.
The idea, I think, speaks to the attraction of the documentary that he was somewhere mm-hmm. that probably no other human being has ever been and then came out the other side. Mm-hmm. You know, like,
and there you go.
The fact that there's like this unknowable place that people are just now getting to, that's the deepest sense of adventure that I think is baked into all of us.
And good idea from the editors and directors to show it over and over again, because I kept thinking to myself, show that again. And they did. Yeah. And then I kept thinking, oh God, I want to see that again. And they did. So anyway, if that doesn't captivate you, you know, this show isn't for you. In the first 10, 15 minutes, I think it is. Okay, well, speaking of captivating, the world was caught by storm last year. Ted Lasso in 2020 was the show of 2020. I'm pretty certain 95% of America watched this show in 2020. The feel-good coach who takes a job to send an English Premier League club into regulation, though that's not his goal. It is kind of sort of the goal of the now owner. Divorced wife, she now owns the club. She kind of wants that to happen, kind of a major league plot, but quickly realizes she doesn't want that to happen because she, like everyone else who watches the show and on the show, really is drawn to Ted Lasso as a guy. Jason Sudeikis is the titular Ted. The second season dropped its first episode on Friday, and that's where we are. I think two-thirds of us have watched that first episode. And Donovan actually just finished the first season, so he's hot off the press with that.
He's just dried his tears.
I really have.
You'll never walk alone.
You don't understand.
Oh, I do understand, buddy. I do.
And then Keeley was so supportive, and then Ted sent a note, and he was kind of like the dad Jamie never had, and it was like, we're just all in this big crazy mess together, you know, guys?
It's so good.
That first season was magical, right? Adam, what did you see in the first episode of season two?
I thought it was pretty good. I thought maybe there were some things that, you know, you can't replicate the magic of Ted showing up in England for the first time. So it kind of had a taller task, I suppose, because it didn't have mm-hmm. as much of an obvious plot point to work through. I saw a great, there's an article or Twitter thread about how they make you love the character Ted Lasso in, like, you know, like 100 seconds or something like that. And they, in that first episode, you know, they put him on screen. He's just a giant mm-hmm. grinning figure behind Scott Van Pelt. And then they show him dance with his players and he's adored. And you're like, I would run through a brick wall for this guy. And he hadn't even said anything yet. And so they work from there. This one, you know, you already have all these characters who are fleshed out. And I did wonder, I mean, obviously the people writing the show have written for television before. They know how to move already existing pieces around. But it was a little bit different. I thought Roy really was a shining star in this one. All his dialogue felt the most earned, I suppose. There were a few moments where it got a little sitcom-y.
Mm-hmm. No, it did. It felt much like I said. We gotta have a situation, right, that draws out the comedy with,
right, or even like when he walks into her office, Rebecca's office after the game, and they all go, Ted, you know, it's kind of like, that was a level of TV moment that maybe didn't happen in the first season, where everything flowed a bit more naturally. But overall, I thought it was really good.
Usually these sorts of shows have some sort of big change or emotional or mental growth with a character or two, some sort of emotional or mental growth spurt. Episode 1 kind of picked up right where it left off with everyone, so I'll be interested to see what they're going to shoot for. I suppose episode 1 of season 2 was just a reminder of where everyone was when you last saw them.
I do think Ted is not okay. You know, I think he
and that's hinted at majorly.
Yeah, he's more off his game than maybe appears, where he was such a rock, you know, land the plane of the first season. I think he's a little off base. Obviously, one of his funnier lines in this episode was, "What are your thoughts on therapy?" He says, not skepticism, but something like that, and Midwestern modesty, something like that. Obviously, he's going to have to work through something on screen with the new character.
That was his best line in this episode, when he talks about his thoughts on therapy.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Me too.
We'll touch base with Ted Lasso even more as we get more episodes under our belt. I think it's going to take a couple episodes before we see what we want to say and what the show wants to say this season. Okay, that's it for us this week. It's been fun. Head to all our social media accounts, enter the giveaway, share your favorite episode of Short Takes, show us your vaccination card, and tag us. You could win. Yes, you. Until then, we will be back next Tuesday, where we will talk about, I don't know. Just join us. We'll figure it all out together.
Giant waves.
See everyone later.